My actual rock bottom is when all those excuses I knew were excuses. That dreadful, dreadful realization, moment of clarity, where I thought, I have got to stop drinking forever. And that was my lowest point.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scofield. In this podcast, I speak to some incredible people about mindset, mental health, addiction, and recovery. And I share my own journey throughout these conversations. So whether you're on your own path of self-discovery, recovery, or transformation, inspired by human stories of mental resilience, or supporting someone who is struggling with addiction, make sure you follow and subscribe to This Is Powerful. There'll be a new episode every Thursday. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. My guest today is a hugely talented, warm, and incredibly humble Kevin Kennedy. Nearly 27 years clean and sober, Kevin is a proud and passionate advocate of recovery. His autobiography, The Street to Recovery, tells the powerful story of his journey through fame, addiction, and recovery, inspiring thousands. Kevin talks about becoming a household name while starring in Coronation Street, finding sobriety with his wife, and staying together against all odds. Kevin has a very intimate message at the end of this podcast for anyone who thinks they may have a problem. Kevin, thank you so much, mate. I know you're busy.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm very happy to be here.
Thank you. We'd love to go back to the beginning for our audience to know who you are and where you're from.
I was born in Manchester from an Irish family. My mother was born in Dublin, as was all her sisters and brothers. One of them, family of eight or nine, I can't remember. And a very, very happy childhood it was. It was full of music and laughter and jokes and Irishness, and all that goes with it. Storytelling, singing, and a lot of fun. And I'm a huge extended family, which also extended into Ireland, obviously. And I had a lovely childhood. Went to school in Manchester. Went to St. Paul's.
How was school in the early 70s in Manchester?
It was a bit mad, wasn't it? I mean,
mine was.
Yeah, it was a bit. I mean, I've seen my schoolmates since then, and you know, I talk about it. And it, for me, I mean, they are very different memories. But for me, I always thought that violence was never far away in the 70s. The teachers didn't know any better. The strap was as used at the time to everyone, girls and boys. So we were kind of brought up on a violent, in violent schools, you know. And then one time they were teaching us, you know, turn the other cheek, and because it's a Roman Catholic school, yeah, and be nice and be good. And on the other hand, they were bashing us with the strap.
Yeah, you're like, you're not exactly doing what you're saying.
That's a bit odd, isn't it? And then obviously with the 70s Manchester, the music scene, the football scene, it was all violent, you know. And but as I say, my other my peers from there don't seem to remember it the same way. So maybe it was just me, but I always felt that it was danger was at every turn. I didn't get into football until I was, I don't know, 12, 13, where me and my mates used to go down and watch Man City, and it was there, it was prevalent, you know, you could feel it, and I quite liked that. It was, I got quite a buzz off that, you know, that atmosphere where really anything could happen, and did on occasion.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw lots of it. I was never involved in it. I was only little, but and that became a lifelong obsession, still is.
So it's great. So you had a good fun upbringing. It sounds like it was already artistic.
Very. My grandmother from Dublin played a mean blues harmonica. Everyone played. I think I was the first one to go towards strings. Everyone played brass. There was a band, the Northern Dunn Brass Band, which was populated by a lot of my family. I had a go at it, but it wasn't for me.
Yeah.
And then I picked up the guitar. And again, that was, again, like football became a passion, I was obsessed, carried it around with me everywhere.
How old was this, Kevin?
10, 11, maybe a bit even before. And I was obsessed with guitars, obsessed. And I had a really good teacher, and he was trying to teach me classical. But then I discovered rock and roll.
Yeah.
And once you discover rock and roll, all that classical stuff goes out the window, although it does come in handy later on. And again, obsessed with music and playing into my formative teenage years. I was always playing, and I still do. You know.
When did you form your first band?
I lived on an estate in Withenshaw, Manchester. And on that estate, the year was about 1974, 75, right? Punk had just erupted. And music before then was quite formatted. They were very, very good at playing guitar anything, or drums or piano. They were accomplished. And then punk happened, and that changed everything. Because all of a sudden, it wasn't about being competent. It was about getting up and having a go, right? So he had all this kind of long hair, 20-minute solos kind of bands around, prog rock, and then you had the Sex Pistols. And when you turned on your local TV at night, you would see people that you knew, that were your age, from your estate where nobody did anything, and they were doing stuff. They were becoming poets, they were becoming writers, they were becoming filmmakers, because the punk revolution wasn't just about music, it was about everything.
Yeah, creation.
Get up, have a go, right? So I on this estate where I lived was a certain gentleman called Johnny Marr, from the Smiths, or later for the Smiths. And Johnny and I and a few others formed a band called the Paris Valentinos.
Where'd that name come from, by the way?
Johnny came up with it.
Did he?
And we were 14.
Yeah.
Right? Now, I didn't put too much credence on it. And then I read Johnny's book, and he put a lot of credence on it because he mentioned it a lot. And I remember very clearly sat in Johnny's bedroom, the age of 14, and he was playing guitar. And I knew I was witnessing something special, but I didn't know what it was. And the hairs on the back of your neck, I don't know, what is that? You know, because he was a beautiful guitarist, very melodic and fast. And I thought, I don't know, what have I just witnessed here?
You know? Amazing.
So that was my first band. As I say, the punk revolution had happened. I was desperate to do something artistic, but I wasn't quite sure which direction I wanted to go in. I'd done drama school youth theatre in Manchester, the Manchester Youth Theatre, which really gave me a taste for that side
of
things.
Whilst you was at school?
Yeah. Yeah. I was 15. All of a sudden, between the ages 14, 15, and 16, that I was just an artistic hand grenade. I was into everything that was artistic, and football thrown in. I was playing guitar. I was playing guitar with Johnny. I was going to the youth theatre. I was in their productions. I was thinking about drama schools. Quite worried because I didn't have the qualifications to get into a drama school, really. Started to audition at the age of 17. I started auditioning for drama schools, all the London ones and all that.
Yeah.
And at the time, there was the Manchester Polytechnic School of Theatre, which was a big thing at the time. They were in the business of producing vocational actors. This is what you're supposed to do. If you go to this drama school, you are expected to become an actor, but a thinking actor.
Yeah.
And people like Julie Walters, David Threlfall, that kind of caliber of actor. Yeah. And I was 18.
Like a real actor's actor.
Yes.
Basically.
Thinking.
Yeah.
Intelligent. And I went and auditioned when I was 18, without the qualifications, but I auditioned anyway, and I got in. And that really set the ball rolling as regards being an actor, because they were, not brutal's the wrong word, thorough, I think's the word, thorough. Yeah. They go, right, this is what you need to do. This is what you need to lose. This is what you need to keep.
And did that work for you?
Yeah.
Precise a bit?
Yeah, it was a whole new world. I mean, I'm from Withenshaw, Manchester. You know what I mean? Like, you know, proper oasis kind of place.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you're mixing with people who speaking received pronunciation. You're going, what's this? But I was like a sponge.
Yeah, amazing. You
know? I just took it all in and still playing.
Did you go, your first stage appearance, was that in Greenwich Theatre?
Yeah.
As a paid job?
Yeah, well, yeah. I'd finished my drama school, and then I went to Spain. I went to mess around in Spain for the summer. And one of those weird times in your life when you think, I've got to go home, don't know why, just think I need to get home. And I got home, and my drama school had been ringing because someone was looking for me. I'd done an audition for an agent, which a lot of drama schools do. You go down to London, they fill a theatre with agents, you do your pieces, and then they take you on or don't take you on, but they're just seeing what new talent's out there. And I'd done this audition, which I didn't get an agent from, but there was a casting person in there who was casting this new play with Warren Mitchell, who played Alf Garnett. And it was a northern comedy. And so, yes, I came back from Spain. I got this phone call, went down for the audition. Audition, got it that day, and I started work on the Monday.
Wow.
And then I made my debut theatre-wise at the Greenwich Theatre in 1983.
That's pretty amazing. There's a short period of time from auditioning for acting school to go to there.
Yeah. It was 3 years.
It's incredible.
4 years and everything happened.
Because some people just stay on for years, don't they? Don't actually manage to get work.
Everything happened in 4 years. And then I was thrust into the world of the West End and theatre and actors. And I loved it. All of a sudden, I was in the West End, a West End actor. I was being taken to places that I would never dreamed I could even get in, never mind go to. There was a drinking club called Macready's, which used to be at the top of Tottenham Court Road. And it was like a speakeasy. And you'd go in there of an evening and you'd see O'Toole in one corner, Harris over there.
Amazing.
And it was like, wow, the heroes, you know. And it went from there, you know, and I loved every minute of it. And I'd become so blinkered, so focused that everything else, sadly, in some cases, there's a few regrets of people I kind of left behind because I was just laser focused.
As in friends at that point?
Yeah, friends, that I had to make amends to later on.
I remember coming home from Milan. I stayed here for 2 months. I had no money. I lived in there was three of us who lived in this one bed crap hole, basically, until we started to get jobs. And I worked for Benetton and Armani and then Versace and Valentino. And I was like, oh, I've got some money.
Mm.
And I remember doing one job that was a lot of money for the day. And I went back to the pub where I come from with the boys. And I was like, oh, so how was all this weird stuff you're doing then? And I was like, mate, I got paid a fortune. I got paid this money. It was incredible. And it was the worst thing I ever said.
Yep.
I got absolutely ousted for that. And I've never spoke about money since, ever.
No.
And it was such a harsh judgment on their behalf, and it was an innocent, like, if I could bring people with me, you should come with me because it's an amazing world to be in.
I know why you did it, because I did exactly the same. And it's not a question of showing off, because that would be just too easy.
Mm.
I wasn't showing off. I think I was just trying to get some confirmation, some, not adoration, what's the word? Approval for what I was doing, right? And I thought then that you get that approval by showing how much money you made, rather than the difference it was having to your life, because your horizons had broadened so much.
Yeah.
And wrongly, I thought, well, these people, you know, they're from Manchester, so that they'll understand money, but they won't understand the art of acting. So I'll just use the lowest common demand. Yeah, that they'll use this money. That's
a brilliant explanation. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's why, because I wanted the approval.
Yeah.
Not for the money. You know, that was just a measure. It's nothing to do with that. It was, I just wanted the approval. Yeah. And I made exactly the same mistake of saying, well, I earned this. And that was the worst thing you could do. And we're very alike. After that, I never talked about that again.
Yeah.
In certain circumstances, it was far too late for that. And by then, the Coronation Street thing was starting. And it's a very odd thing. You could be a massive star in the West End, but that means nothing in the North. Mm. Nothing. Nothing. You get into Coronation Street, that's when it changes. And that's when my life really took a turn, because I was suddenly in Coronation Street.
Mm. You're in everyone's front room then, though, aren't you?
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, my mum and dad had been down to, God love them, they'd been down to the West End. When I did that first West End, the opening night was on, Duke of York's Theatre. And there's a balcony outside. And the opening night, my dad was there, mum was there, they had a glass of champagne. The world and his wife was there, you know, the great and the good, yeah, of the West End Theatre and the glitterati. And the fashionistas, everyone was there. And I had done the show and my dad was there. And I said, what do you think? He went, well, you've proved a point, but I can still get you an apprenticeship at Kellogg's.
Yeah. Said.
Yeah.
Wow. Did that hurt?
No.
Was that just...
No, because I understood what he was saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Well, totally that's cool. That. That's all right. But when I got into Coronation Street, there was a difference. Wow. Yeah. You're in Coronation Street. Yeah, and I went up to Coronation Street and to me, Coronation Street at that point was as a home gig, right? As a jobbing actor, it's a home gig. Get your washing done. Your mum's, you don't have to pay for digs. It's a home gig, right? Brilliant. It wasn't, the importance of it did not register with me. I had two episodes, a week off, and then two episodes. So in the middle week, I thought, I can sign on, right? Because I'm not working.
Yeah.
So I went up to my mum's, did the first two episodes, got my washing done, went, got the bus into Stockport to sign on. The usual thing, you know, the lady behind the thing. Have you been working? Looking for, I said, yeah, I was working. I was working last week. What were you working on? I was doing that Coronation Street. Boom. What? I've just done two episodes of Coronation Street. I've got a week off now and I've got another two episodes next week. So I'd like to claim for this week, please. You were in Coronation Street. Yes. We haven't seen it. Well, it'll be out in a month or so. Hey, you know, see him here? He's just been doing Coronation Street. No, he's off this week. He's signing on this week, but he's doing two episodes next week. Yeah. Yeah, what's your name? And all that kind of thing. And that, all oh, right, I'll do brilliant. Your claim straight away, love. And I was like, that's the power of Coronation Street. I mean, I've been in the West End, you know, it was a top show and I'd done a few televisions before that, like some great plays. I worked with Stephen Frears, a massive film director, on a TV show with Jim Broadbent and all kinds of wonderful people. But that was all, no, it's Coronation Street.
Brilliant.
And I'm not, I mean, I'm so happy, you know, yeah. I'm not decrying that or trying to diss it. It was a wonderful experience. And was very formative for me in a lot of ways.
At that point, because that's a big shift, it can be a big shift, because that power and recognition can change people in a way. Was you drinking at that point?
Yeah.
When did you start to drink?
Well, like most kids, there was nothing special about my drinking in the early days. It was just, I think, probably the same as everyone else's, you know, 13, 14, down the park, a couple of cans. Johnny, Mart, and I used to go and drink Breakers for some reason. There's a can of called Breaker, and we used to go to clubs and sort of drink Breakers and have makeup on and look dead hard, you know, nothing mad. During the drama school experience, my drinking was pretty much the norm. You know, the first year you go mad because you're a fresher, you know, and then you sort of calm down and get on with it. I didn't so much calm down and get on with it. I just kept drinking, you know. Coronation Street came along, well, the theatre, which was a massively drinking culture.
Yeah.
You know, I'd go to work, I'd finish for 10 to 10 and then I'd be out. But I was 20, 23. I was just doing what everyone else
you
was doing.
You can just bounce back there as well, can't
you? And then I'd sleep all day and do the job at night, you know. And I thought that was it. And my heroes like O'Toole and Harris and all that were those rare creatures who could put the champagne bottle down in the wings and go on and do a perfect Hamlet or perfect Macbeth or King Lear. But yeah, they were my hero. I liked that idea. I was very much into the romantic idea of being a rogue and a vagabond and going from town to town, breaking hearts, one step ahead of the law. You know, I'm an actor. This is what I do, man. You know, I was in that romantic side of things really appealed to me. Yeah. It was very far from reality. When I got into Coronation Street, my drinking was for a long time was again normal. I was doing again massive drinking culture within the industry within TV in the early 80s. You know, people used to go off to the pub at lunchtime, which is unheard of now. You know, they'd go down the pub and then they'd come back and work.
Totally normal.
Yeah, absolutely, totally normal. I was quite disciplined in the fact that when I was actually filming, I didn't drink. And that lasted quite a while. It wasn't until much later on, a lot of really kind of bad stuff happened to me, which I don't really want to go into, except to say there was, it was affairs of the heart, which went wrong, dreadfully wrong. And I was young and I was hurt and I was vulnerable. I'd like to say that was an excuse for drinking, but it wasn't. I mean, I just liked it, yeah. But it was kind of a hodgepodge. It was a mixture of everything. But during this really sort of dark period, I was doing Hamlet, which is not the most joyful of plays. You know, there's a lot of suicide in it, and despair and darkness and murder and. And it kind of really sort of suited my mood at that time. But I sort of came out of it and then I was having a bit of a rough time and then I met my present wife, Claire, which was a godsend. I'd been through maybe a period of maybe 5-6 years of horribleness. Sort of learning to deal with fame, which wasn't a problem. I joined a band, right, which was a great help. And it was a dance band and great fun.
Like an outlet, really.
Yeah, it was an Irish show band. And I was the bass player. It was never advertised, never.
Wow.
It never said Kevin Kennedy from Coronation Street on bass, never. Just the name of the band. And we were called the Borderline and we played all round the UK, mostly in the Northwest. And we were a dance band. We played for 2 hours and I was at the back playing the bass. And it became a weird kind of Mancunian secret. Like, yeah.
Nice freedom though, just to do that, right?
Because I couldn't cope with the being in a headlock outside, string fellows being papped. And
how do you deal with that? Because it's hard to be, I had a weird message this morning, by the way, I'm on Instagram. We get a lot that comes to our charity and foundation, usually asking for help and stuff. But there's a couple of people. I'd put a clip out of a succession of really good people we've had on that have been very generous with their time and their stories.
Yeah.
And this person, they'd messaged me before about something and I could see there was a negative person. And then they put something out this morning saying, well, these people, just because they've had a few problems with drinking drugs, because they're famous, they can afford it, can't they? And it really got me, and I was going to bombard this guy back. And I was like, do you know what?
Nah. Well, they don't understand, and why should they?
Yeah.
Why should they understand?
But it's a weird general brand.
They've not been in that situation. Yeah. You know, I understand what you're saying, and I totally empathize with you, sympathize with what you're saying, but they don't know. They don't know. People just go, people love to say to me, oh, your problems with drinking drugs was that due to fame? No. Mm. No. It would have happened to me no matter what. All it did was being famous was speed up the process because I had the means to do it, right? Where some people don't have the means. Mm. I had the means to do it because I had the money, right? It was nothing to do with fame. Yes, there was adjustments. Yes, I had to really think about what I was doing. But the drink and the rest of it, no, that would have happened anyway. That would have, and they often say, what was your, you know, what was your lowest point? It's kind of a journal question. What's your lowest point? And they want some story of debauchery. And I said, I'll tell you, my lowest point was when I knew I had to give it up. That was the lowest point. That was my rock bottom, when I knew that I couldn't do it anymore.
When I was 28, I was living between Miami and LA. No, sorry, New York and Miami, and things were getting bad. And why they were getting bad was because I swore that Miami was going to be the place that I rested and went to the gym, looked good to go back to work in New York, and it become mad. And I would lock myself in for a few days and, you know, it become pretty dark. And then I went to LA and it became nice for a while. And then the last year was really bad. But I was trying to take, I remember we lived in a beautiful house in Los Feliz. There was two mates lived upstairs and two of us lived downstairs. And it was a really nice time. But I remember things like this kid, Dave, he was an actor. He was in the other side downstairs. I'd be like, why is this guy not washing up? Why does he keep leaving his shit in the fucking sink? And I would argue with him, and he's like, Paul, I haven't eaten in the house. That's you. I'm like, I would never do that. There's a dishwasher. What the fuck? And I used to think, is he winding me up, or have I done that? Mm. And I started to have like these weird things, thinking, is it them? Is it me?
Yeah, paranoia.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, all the stuff you've just described, like promising yourself this, I'll get a new coat or a haircut, went through all that. But my actual rock bottom is when all those excuses I knew were excuses. That dreadful, dreadful realization, moment of clarity, where I thought, I have got to stop drinking forever. And that was my lowest point. There was a time when I was trying to do a deal with myself.
Yeah.
You know, I know. And this is our madness. All right, say I drink for another 3 years and then die. It becomes feasible.
Mm.
And you're thinking, you know, that'll be all right. 3 years. What madness is this?
Yeah. That's, but it's plausible at the time.
It's plausible.
Yeah.
You're thinking, yeah, I'll do that. I won't give up. I'll just drink myself to death. That's what I'll do. And like, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
So when I realized I could not, I will never drink. I can never drink again. I can't drug. I can't. My world had ended. I thought, that's it. You know, what am I going to do now? Yeah. You know, I was going to meetings, which I hated. I hated it.
Did you go before you went to the Priory?
No, I went to the Priory, which I was at my lowest then because I knew the game was up. I was absolutely dripping in shame because it was very public fall from grace. And I started to go to meetings then, and I hated it. I thought, I've got nothing in common with these people. I've got a tan, for God's sake. You know, who are these? I mean, they're lovely people, and I wish them well. You know, but who? Yeah. Me? Look at me. I've got a tan. You know, I could drive a car. I've got a sports car. Yeah, you know, what have I got in common with these people?
Mm.
Yeah, you know, mad. and ego-led. But I went anyway. I think I went because I was more scared. I was scared of being caught drinking again. That was what kept me going for a while, because I thought I'm being watched, a bit of paranoia, I'm being watched. And actually, maybe there was some truth in that. I don't know. As you said before, that they did have a habit of watching us, the media, whatever we were doing. So I thought, I'm being watched. I've got to go to these meetings. I can't face the shame of being caught drinking again. I started to slowly but surely listen. Yeah, I wasn't clock watching. I wasn't, oh God, I've got another hour, an hour and a half of this rubbish. I started to actually listen to stuff. And the room that I was in, I'll never forget, it was an old scout hut, stank of pee. There was canoes across the ceiling. It was all creaky and dark. And on the people in there were actually, I thought, quite mad. And I hated that room. After a sort of 6 months or so, I started to love that room. Everything started to make sense. And I battered the meetings. I mean, I did what was suggested. I went on a Sunday night. I went on a Monday night. I went on a Wednesday night, unless City were at home. And if City were at home, I would go to the match, but I'd go Thursday, then I'd go Friday, and then I'd go Sunday. And I did that solid for 6 months. I'd like to say, I wish I could sit here and tell you that, yeah, I did a lot of hard work on myself, and I just sat there and listened. I just sat there and listened and absorbed it all.
Yeah.
And that's how, when it started. And then that's when life actually started to feel a lot better. My wife had been in, he was starting her recovery. We didn't know how that was going to go, you know, because we were drinking pals, big drinking pals. And sometimes when you sober up, you know, you might not like the other person.
Yeah.
Touch wood, thank God. We did. And we began our journey almost together, although we did keep it separate because, you know, we didn't go to the same meetings and things like that. And
that's amazing, though, because you the fear is that your common buddy in the middle, in the glass, it might change you both. But actually, if you can come together sober, then it's incredible.
Yeah, it's a miracle, because we, you know, a lot of couples who drink together and get sober together don't stay together. But we have. Probably because I'm on tour all the time. I'm never at home. But miracles started to happen, you know, because of my drug abuse and this and all the rest of it. There was no chance of children. And then we went down the road of IVF. And on the day that I found out that my wife was pregnant with our first child was the actual day that Coronation Street turned around and said, "We're actually letting you go," which to any other actor in the soap world is possibly the worst thing could possibly happen to you. By this time, I was 5 years sober. We'd been trying for a child. I'm in the office. We found out that morning that my wife was pregnant, and the poor producer had to tell me I was being sacked, and he couldn't work out why I had this huge grin on my face. And you know what? It didn't matter.
Yeah.
It didn't matter. I was going, yeah, okay.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was okay. And that in itself was down to being sober and seeing the world in a different way. People think I'm a bit of a tree hugger and see the loveliness in everything. And sometimes I can. Sometimes I can't. But on this particular occasion, I just thought, well, you know what? So what? I've got a baby coming.
Yeah.
And then I got back into my first love, which was theatre. And this time I got into putting my two loves together, which was theatre and music, and I started to do musicals. And I thought, well, you can't get any better than this, man. I mean, working wise, it was great. Yeah, it was tough because I had to leave home a lot. But my wife got to bring up her own children. She didn't have to work. So she had that luxury, and which it is these days, is to be able to look after your own children.
Yeah.
And we were blessed, and that paid dividends later on. Those two girls now are 21 and 18. And touch wood, they've never seen me or their mum take a drink or a drug.
When you talk about tree hugging, it's funny, isn't it? I don't know whether it's the background you're from, but it's always a little bit like, yeah, I'm not really a tree hugger, but I do see the coincidences and I do love stuff. I am a tree hugger.
Yeah.
I literally take my kids into the forest where we are and we go, let's hug this tree today, is our favourite tree. Because I come from such a heavy place that I like to go, I'm happy to hug a tree and not be ashamed of it.
Good for you, man.
You know, yeah. I like the freedom of that.
I live by the sea, right? I'm from the industrial north. And the other day I was having a particularly, not a bad day, but something was bugging me, you know. Things weren't going my way. Now, as an addict, when things don't go my way, I get cross, right? I can't hand it over, or I can hand it over for 5 minutes and then I'm taking the reins back again. If it doesn't work, I'm taking the reins back. I went down and just, I know it's just, this totally sounds unlike me, but I went down and I sat and watched the sea for 5 minutes and I went, yeah, it doesn't matter, does it? Does it matter? I mean, look at that. There's a great line from a Stephen King book. I think it's A Shawshank Redemption, and it said, the sea has no memory. And I went, yeah. Don't ask me how that fits. It just felt like a really clever thing to say just then.
I get that. Because when you're really heavy thinking about something and it gets you going, and then all of a sudden you can realise that there is clarity or another way of doing something. But that's powerful, because when I was in addiction, I didn't know there was another way of looking at stuff. I couldn't get these thoughts out of my head. There was only one way, and that was in for a packet for me, or some alcohol, or something else, or a pill. But I was going to say, when the cover of your book, you're so lit up. It's such a freedom and light in your eyes. I love the cover of that book.
Thank you.
It's a picture of like, fuck me, how'd you get there?
From that.
There.
Yeah.
And in itself, the cover just says it all.
Yeah.
You know, it really does. It really is amazing.
What I love about that book is I wrote it between Act 1 and Act 2 of We Will Rock You in the West End. I was at the Dominion Theatre. I'd open the show.
Right? And it was 2:13.
Yeah, around there. And then I wouldn't be on for about an hour. And then I'd come on and do the last 30 minutes as this kind of mad Ben Elton style character stand-up. So I wrote a lot of the stuff in between Act 1 and Act 2.
No way.
Right? And then my favourite is when eventually when the sort of royalty came in, I went to a Disney specialist. My girls were little then; they're about 7 and 5. I want 4 flights to Walt Disney World in Florida. I want all the princesses, right? I want a nice hotel, right? I want all the experiences. They've got to meet everyone. And there's the money. And it's gone.
How beautiful.
It was great, man.
How beautiful. What an experience.
It was great. There you go.
Oh, how loving.
Yeah, that was brilliant.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was. It was great.
I did a film in 2000, I think it was 12, whatever, a Warner Brothers film called Dee Dee Hollywood. And I worked with Peter Coyote and Elsa Pataki on his film. And Peter took me under his wing. He's an amazing actor. He's also a Buddhist monk. He was not drinking and stuff. First time I met him, I was quite nervous on the set. And the first time I met him, he walked me up to this hill in Valencia for 6 hours. And we just talked life and stuff. And it was amazing. Totally reset me. But when we did the premiere for the film, it was really lovely because I was looking out of my eyes, completely clear and humbled and signing as you do going along. And we had the party and stuff. And I said, I'm going to leave it here, if you don't mind. And I went up to my hotel and I sat and had a very English cup of tea, looking over Madrid. And it was one of the moments where I'm like, wow, how lucky is this? And people might not understand that, but for someone who would have just been battered, that cup of tea was the best tasting tea I had.
Love it, man. I understand totally. I took over, I played Caractacus Potts in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. Massive role. And I opened it up in Singapore. And there was a huge party afterwards. And I was so pleased with myself that I'd actually, I mean, it was huge, very challenging. And I went to a Häagen-Dazs place. Everyone else was off partying and doing all sorts of madness. And I just sat and got a big tub of Häagen-Dazs sat there because I love my cake. And I just sat there eating this. And I thought, you know, this
can't
is
get
fine.
Better.
I'm more than happy with this huge chocolate ice cream. Yeah. More than happy.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
It's great. Yeah, I love all that.
The foundation you have, you guys doing with Claire, do an amazing, amazing job.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about it?
Yeah. Well, we Kennedy Street, isn't it? It's called Kennedy Street Recovery. Now, Kennedy Street was an idea that we had 10 years ago because we were very long story short. We were in Miami, down on the Keys. We were looking for a meeting and we found a meeting and it was like a clubhouse. We thought, this is brilliant. It was like, there was CA on one side, which is Cocaine Anonymous, and AA on the other, which was Alcoholics Anonymous. And in the middle was kind of a coffee bar. We thought, this is a brilliant idea, brilliant idea. So that's, we thought we've got to open one of these. So that, and that started the ball rolling. Then we got into the idea of dry bars. And that wasn't going to be working. Everyone was doing it and it just wasn't right. So the idea of Kennedy Street was in the ether for many, many years. It was just it was an email address, and we tried to help anyone because when we got sober, there wasn't much help out there.
Yeah.
Right? And it was a lot of it was shame based, and we wanted to get rid of that. And our aim was going, why can't we just have people who have been in recovery to shout it loud and proud, you know? The disease gets lots of press, you know, open the newspaper.
Yeah.
Mother at school gates, 88 million times over the limit, whatever. Football hooligans, oh, it was down to booze, this, that. Forget that. Let's talk about the solution.
Yeah.
Let's, if you're a CEO of a big company and you're in recovery, shout it, you know, let's get rid of the shame thing. So round about, as I say, it was in the ether. Round about the time that the COVID hit, we just got a helpline set up with the help of the lottery, and then COVID hit, and this line went completely crazy because people were at home, they were self-medicating, people were scared, they didn't know what was going to happen. This helpline went mad, right? And all of a sudden, there was a snowballing effect. We managed to get a building off Brighton Council, which is beautiful. We're right in the middle of Brighton. We now have a community hub. We do not accept people with the hand out.
Yeah.
Right? If you've got your hand up saying, I need recovery, not what can you give me? What? No. If you want recovery and you want to learn about it, then you come here. It's like a cafe. You sit down, you have a cup. Everything starts with a cup of tea, right? Tell me what the problem is. We can work you through it. We can point you in the right direction. We can offer training. It's a dropping calf. Every person at the hub is in recovery, right? So there's no shame.
Mm.
No shame. It doesn't matter what drug, what's your drug of choice, how much trouble you've been in. All we expect you to do is go, I just need help, right?
What a beautiful concept.
That's what it's all about. We can't give you anything, right? We can teach you. We can point you in the right direction. We can't offer you a place somewhere. We have contacts, you know, for rehabs, you know. And if everything we try to do is for free, you know, we try to point you in the right direction where it's not going to cost you anything because we know what it's like. Sometimes we get places, sometimes we don't. But it's not about that. It's a community. It's a community within a community. You just come in, sit down, talk to other people. And this is how it works. You talk about your experiences as an addict, as an alcoholic, and you share it with another person. And when you've shared that, you get people recognizing themselves in that story. Mm. That's how it works. Right? It's not, we are very 12-step. That's what we encourage. But for me personally, it's having the recognition with another human being, and that feeling that you're not on your own, that some other person has had the same mad, manic ridiculous, dangerous thoughts that you've had. So all of a sudden, you're not on your own. And it's important.
It's key. It's so powerful. It's so well said, because it's it's the most loneliest disease, yeah, illness or habit, however you want to frame it.
Yeah.
But having that connection which you provide is amazing. Yeah. It's like having two magnets the wrong way around. It just pushes you away. But yeah, once you're there, whack, it pulls you. Yeah.
I love it. Yeah. Because, you know, we've got a lot of success stories as people come in, and we've seen them grow, and they've become volunteers, and now they work for us. And you can see it in their faces when they're passing on the knowledge. Yeah. And it's a beautiful thing to see. But I have to say, this is I was talking to Claire yesterday. I said, I don't tell you enough. I'm so, so proud of you, because it's her baby. I just go around the world playing dress up. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's Claire's baby. Claire's put the effort in. Claire does all that work. Claire's there every day. Every day, making sure everything's fine.
Yeah.
I'm off being a rock star here, there, and what have you. And I turn up when I can and do my bits. But it's Claire. She can't. I cannot give her enough praise and love for what she does there.
Yeah, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of passion and stuff to put in.
Yeah,
I get that. But it's also key, because having a voice like what you're doing, like what we're doing here today, yeah, the reason we set this up was to show there's a possibility of recovery. Yeah. It's not all doom and gloom, what we read about.
No.
That it's a free piece that you can listen to on your couch, in the bus, in the car, yeah, wherever, and listen to similarities, listen to stories where, yeah, you can say, oh, fucking hell, if they've done that, then maybe I can do that.
A massive intervisible recovery. Yeah. Massive into it. Yeah. Recovery is the new rock and roll anyway. I mean,
it's definitely
new
1%.
Yeah. All your pop stars, and no one drinks anymore.
Yeah.
Not really. Even the boys, the Oasis, they go, we don't do it anymore, do we? You know what I mean? No, they've just given it all up. They go running and stuff like that. And good, and fair play to them, you know. But it's visible recovery. And believe me, if you're listening to this and you think you may have a problem, if you think it's getting too much, you don't want to admit it to yourself, so there's only me and you. Listen, if you listen to this, there's only me and you, right? If you think you've got a problem, all you've got to do is ask for help. No one has to know about it. All you've got to do is say to someone, I think I'm drinking too much. Someone who knows what they're talking about. Don't feel shamed about it. Just go and ask for some help. Maybe you're okay. Maybe you're just going through a rough time. Or maybe you're addicted. You're dependent on the stuff. Now, if that's the case, it's not the end of the world. Could be the start of it.
Thanks, Kevin. We'll put all your stuff in the show notes so people can find where Please you do. Are. Thank you very much. This is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com, where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also donate. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. Please rate, follow, and subscribe to the show. Why? This will help the algorithm make us more visible to others who need help. And share this podcast with your family, friends. Head over to social media at Paul Scolfort and at @this_is_powerful. You'll get to see what's coming up, and you can get in touch with us, because I love hearing about you. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica Amati, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Emma Long, who does all the hard work in the background. Thank you also to Ria Musa and the rest of the team. Did you know also you can watch us on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scolfort. Hi, everybody. I'd really love to hear your views so that we can produce a podcast with the content that matters to you. It doesn't matter if you just joined us or if you've been listening from the start. We would love you to fill in the short listener feedback form, which you can find in the show notes. and let me know your thoughts on our podcast. It would really mean a lot. Thanks, guys.